The interview portion of this podcast was recorded on August 19th, 2023. And the introduction was recorded on February 26, 2024. Welcome to Against Japanism Podcast, and the first episode of 2024. I apologize for a very long delay in releasing this episode. Since October 7th of last year, I've been very busy with the organizing and mobilizing work related to Palestine. In addition to my previous organizational commitment in solidarity with the Philippine Revolution, I also started a new job in September, and that has kept me busy as well. I'm glad to be back with this new episode though, which I'm going to introduce in a moment, but first I'd like to make an important announcement. In order to make this podcast more of a collective effort than my personal project, I will be co-hosting this episode and future episodes with other activists from Nikkei and Japanese communities. Many of the listeners of this podcast are members of these communities, and my hope is that with this restructuring, Against Japanism can continue to radicalize the listeners' perspective on Japan, raise proletarian class consciousness, and help their organizing work wherever they are located in the capitalist imperialist world system. For this episode, I will be joined by Maya, whom I organize with in Japanese Canadians for Social Justice, based in Toronto. Maya and I spoke to Lu Phuong An about the struggle of Vietnamese migrant workers and international students in Japan. Lu Phuong An is a PhD student at the Graduate School of Asia-Pacific Studies at Waseda University, whose research interest is in migration studies and international student mobility, as well as Vietnamese middle-skill migrant workers in Japan. She is the co-author of Against the Japanese Dream, Vietnamese Student Workers in Japan, published in Asian Labor Review in December 2022. According to Japan's Ministry of Labor, as of 2023, Vietnamese workers constituted 25% of all migrant workforce in Japan, totaling 2 million, the highest number on record. They constitute 51.8% of a group of migrants working under a visa called the Technical Internship Program. An specifically highlights the experience of so-called technical interns, who are misleadingly categorized as interns, but in practice are imported and exploited as the source of cheap labor. Because their immigration status is tied to their workplace and cannot change their jobs, they are vulnerable to abuse and various human rights violations by their employers. We also discussed the plight of Vietnamese international students who are in a relatively less precarious position than the technical interns, but still experience downward class mobility due to indebtedness and having to cover the cost of living and tuition fees for profit-driven private language schools. We discussed the intersection between migrant and reproductive justice issues through the case of Lu Tin Thuy Linh, a Vietnamese woman and technical intern who was criminalized and acquitted for abandoning her stillborn twins, and other topics such as the media's role in enabling anti-migrant, anti-Vietnamese racism, and the root cause of forced labor migration from the global south to the global north. We conclude our discussion by talking about how migrants and their supporters are fighting back against migrant exploitation and Japan's unjust migration policies. This episode was recorded on August 19th, 2023, and since then, some important changes have taken place. Earlier this month, the Japanese government announced it is ending the technical internship program and replacing it with a new program whereby workers will be conditionally allowed to switch jobs after 2 years of their arrival. Under the new program, workers will be allowed to apply for Specified Skilled Workers, SSW, Type 1 Visa, which allows workers to stay in Japan for 5 years, and SSW Type 2 Visa, which allows workers to stay in Japan indefinitely and eventually bring their families. According to one report, the original proposal was to limit the period workers cannot change their jobs to 1 year, but the ruling Liberal Democratic Party objected to it on the grounds that this could lead to a massive flow of workers from rural to urban areas. And as a result, the period was extended to 2 years. This is an important victory and a product of tireless campaigning and mobilizing that migrant rights organizations undertook to bring light to this issue and fight for migrant justice. However, the fight is not over yet, and it is too early to tell if the announced changes will actually be codified into law and protect the workers from abuse. Within the 2 years, they will not be allowed to change their employers. Furthermore, the Japanese government is currently proposing a bill to make it easier to revoke permanent residency of migrants if they fail to pay taxes and social insurance security premiums, or become convicted of a crime for up to 1 year of imprisonment. This would effectively render permanent residency meaningless. The reasoning for this bill is also couched in a xenophobic view of migrants as more prone to breaking the law and committing crimes, as if Japanese people never do these things. There have been many cases of powerful Japanese people like politicians and business owners evading taxes. Overall, this is an attempt by the Japanese ruling class to undercut the gains made in the ending of the technical internship program and keep the migrants in a constant state of fear, anxiety, and precarity so that they will remain a docile and easily exploitable labor force. More importantly, as long as Japan remains capitalist and an imperialist nation complicit in the underdevelopment of colonial and semi-colonial nations through the World Bank, IMF, and the US-led wars of aggression, as we are currently witnessing in Palestine, there will always be migrants and refugees coming to Japan, and capitalists seeking super profit through the exploitation of cheap migrant labor. In other words, unless imperialism as a root cause of forced migration is addressed, there will never be genuine migrant justice in the global north. Having said this, I believe this interview Maya and I did with Anne will serve as a reminder of how inhumane the treatment of Vietnamese migrants in Japan has been and currently is. Even though the specific program of technical internship is being abolished, as well as the challenges that lie ahead of migrants and their allies in Japan. If you like what you hear in this episode and previous episodes of this podcast, please consider subscribing to my Patreon to support this project financially through the link included in the show note. Special thanks to the patrons in the 8th Root Army tier and above, who are Nak, Christy Lin, Joma, Drew Harrison, Sean S., and Aiden. Without further ado, here is Against Japanism podcast interview with Lu Phuong An on the struggle of Vietnamese migrant workers in Japan. Enjoy.
So thanks again, An, for joining us today. How did you come to study this topic? And would you mind sharing with us your life story?
Yes. Okay, so when I was an undergraduate student in Japan, my major was international relations. So back then I was studying things like politics, security or political development. And I really thought that I would be a political scientist because most of my friends were also aiming for that position. And until I met a professor at my university and took all of his courses on sociology, he was a professor of sociology, I started to develop an interest in migration studies because he was also researching on this topic. And he encouraged me to develop my bachelor thesis from a term paper of his class, which was focusing on the life, the working life of the illegal working life of Vietnamese students in Japan. And at that time, it was not very easy for me to research on migration topic because all the people around me were doing politics and they were kind of looked down on me. They think this is not like an important topic compared to like politics or security. Even one of the professor who was teaching the class on thesis writing, he told me that my topic was not worth it to study. It was too obvious. So, but I'm glad that I didn't give up. And then I got accepted into Waseda University. And then I was surrounded by, even until now, I'm surrounded by people who do research on migration studies. And it's my honor to be supervised by my professor, Professor Gracia Liu Ferrer. She's one of the most outstanding researchers of migration studies in Japan.
Great. Thank you so much for that introduction. We wanted to speak to you about your article on Asian labor review. And I came across it from my friend who shared it on our social media. And the title immediately really struck me. You know, it's called Against the Japanese Dream. And this podcast is called Against Japanism. So I immediately proceeded to read it. And yeah, I was really, I found it to be very informative. I knew a little bit about Vietnamese migrant workers. Actually, Maya and I campaigned in support of a Filipino migrant detainee a couple years ago. And so we both studied some of the conditions that migrants experience in Japan. And I also had an episode with Migrante Japan, which is an organization of Filipino migrants, mostly migrant workers in Japan. But particular experience of and the struggle of Vietnamese workers, I still have a lot to learn. And I think Maya does too. So yeah, we really wanted to talk to you about the article. And your article is specifically about Vietnamese migrants who come to Japan formally as international students. But there has also been workers from Vietnam who come to Japan through other types of visas, such as technical internship program, which is notorious for a lot of human rights violations by the employers toward the workers and is allegedly being abolished right now. We'll see how that goes. But so before we talk about the student workers, can you tell us about the history of Vietnamese migration to Japan and how it changed over time and how the experience of student workers you discuss in the article fit into this picture?
Okay, actually, I when I saw this question, I actually thought about like the whole history back then, like long time ago, from the beginning of 20th century. Was that something you wanted to ask about?
Yeah, because I only know about the sort of like the labor issues and their conditions in recent years. But I really wanted to know how this is a part of the broader history of the relationship between Japan and Vietnam. So,
Okay.
Yeah, just an overview is fine. You don't have to go into, you know, minuscule details.
Yes.
If you could give us an overview of that history, that would be really cool.
Okay, yes. So I don't know much about history, but I will talk about what I know about the situation. So before talking about history, so we can see currently in Japan first. So now it's surprising to me in a way, but now Vietnam is the second biggest foreign population in Japan, just behind Chinese. And I have to say, I'm very impressed with this number. And as I said, I don't know much about history, but to my knowledge and what I studied back in school, I think Vietnamese people started moving to Japan since the beginning of 20th century. So at that time, Vietnamese scholars were sent to Japan and study about Japan with the hope to kind of like develop Vietnam at that moment. But then because at that time, Vietnam was under the colonization of France still. And then because French and Japanese have a very close relationship during the war, so because of that alliances, I think the French people asked Japanese government not to accept Vietnamese scholars anymore. So that's when most of the scholars were sent back to Vietnam. Some of them could still remain in Japan, as I heard. And then after that, it was during the Vietnam War in 1970s. Now, Japan also accepted refugees from Vietnam. And then cut to the early 2000s, more people were sent to Japan for studying and working. And then I think it was during like 2013, 2014, it was like there was a huge boost of Vietnamese people in Japan, mostly like language school students, when Japan was open to accept more international students. And then this is also the time when many Vietnamese came to Japan under the TITP, the Technical Intern Trainee Program. They came to Japan under the TITP status. And then the students in my article that I wrote, they are the newcomers to the Japanese society. They are not the one who have family move here like during the 20th centuries or have family coming here during the Vietnam War. They just came to Japan by themselves. And then the thing is like, Japan, not until 2019, they have been always using international students and technical interns as like the side door for the shortage of labor. So when we think about it, like technical interns, of course, we call them as workers, but then they are not recognized as workers at all. So probably this is the point when it gives the way, like it paves the way for all of the like abuse over them, or like they don't get paid enough because they are not recognized as workers from beginning. So it's very problematic when Japan refused to accept these kind of like middle skill labor workers and just keep using technical interns or international students to fill in this shortage of labor. And then earlier I mentioned that not until 2019, right? Like Japan had been using this side door. And then not until 2019, they started to rethink about the idea of like this problem. I think because international students or technical interns probably are not enough to keep the economy anymore with the cheap yen. And like many students after learning in Japan, many of them tend to go back as well. So they have to kind of like redefine how they think about skilled migrant workers. So in the past, right, when we think about it, they never really want to accept these people to work in factories or restaurants like officially. But since they are very desperate now, they have to come up with a new visa category. And they say, oh, okay, the people who work in factories or restaurant are also skilled workers. So yes, and this new visa is called the SSW, the Specified Skilled Workers. And this is actually my PhD project. I will research on this topic, this category of visa. Yes, so I hope that my explanation was clear.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, there is definitely a misleading aspect of it. Perhaps deliberate miscategorization of workers as interns. And it's also couched in the logic of international development or Japan as a sort of benevolent figure of assisting developing countries, you know, acquire skills in Japan, assuming that Japan is a, you know, more developed nation. But it's really a way of exploiting cheap labor, it seems.
Mm.
So what are the ways in which the Japanese bosses exploit Vietnamese student workers? And what do their experiences tell us about the underlying problems in contemporary Japanese society?
Yes, so about this one, I would say from my experience and from my observation, mostly, I realized that the Vietnamese student workers still have a much better life compared to the technical interns, because with students, there's one thing is they can just quit their job at any time. If they don't feel like this is like a right workplace for them, they have the exit option. But when like a technical interns have problems at work, it's very difficult or nearly impossible for them to change the job because their visa is tied to one employer only. And talking about, yeah, when I see this question, I'm not so sure, like, how can I just grasp the idea of exploitation at work? So I would say, put in a simple way, when students have the exit options, many of them don't hold back, but it's very normal to be looked down on at work in any places like factories or restaurants, just because you are foreigners and you are from Vietnam. They also kind of like see your intelligence based on your language, your Japanese language skill. So yeah, it's just a very sad situation. But then still, when we think about it, they are still lucky when they have the exit option. I could tell you, I don't know if you would want to know, but I would tell you a little bit more about the situation of the technical interns. They actually experience like very bad situations.
Please do share.
So with technical interns, as I said before, like no matter how bad the situation is, unless it's like an extreme case, it's very difficult for them to change their employer. And now I'm working as an interpreter for like an NPO in Tokyo. This NPO is supporting technical interns or like foreign workers and even Japanese young workers in Japan. And mostly I support them with the interpretation and translation for Vietnamese technical interns. And then I'm supporting a case where a male technical intern, he got like his, so now it's 2/3 of one of his finger is gone. And the company is refusing to paying him like enough money. So first they, like when the accident happened, they kind of lied to the police. So instead of saying it happened like this, they make it sound like a different way. So it's not the company's fault. But because he couldn't speak Japanese and everything was... And they kind of like blame the worker in a way, saying like, you cannot talk about this with anyone, because if you talk about this, the police will recognize that you are working in this field without the license or something. So the company really forced him to stay like silent about it. And they told the police a different story, and then they didn't really process his documents, like when he can receive some of his money back. They just sent him to hospital and that's it. And he was very upset. That's why he found the NPO and now we're supporting him. And it's been almost a year now. His accident happened back in November. And it's almost a year and the company is still trying their best to reduce the money they have to pay. So, yeah, so it's very problematic situation now, because the situation is still going on and he's still working in the company. So he feels very uncomfortable every day. He just want to finish it fast. But then there's one thing, if you want to finish things fast, it means that you have to cut the negotiation and you have to accept like very low amount of the money from the company. So I understand it's a difficult situation for him. We just have to, yeah, until now, we still have to like talk to him, kind of like persuade him every day to try to wait, and so he can receive the most money he could. So this is just a very, very like small story, but there are a lot more stories about technical interns have been talked about on the Japanese media. But I don't think the media itself, like, they talk a lot about this unless it's very extreme cases. When we see the media, always they focus on like, oh, technical interns like robbery or like murdering people, those kind of thing. You know, media loves this kind of thing, right? Like bad criminal cases. Yeah, so yeah, I'm sorry, but yeah, just because I'm working on this case, I just want to share a little bit about the situation.
Right. And so what I'm hearing is there's a lack of labor rights as well as a lack of workers' safety rights. And
yes,
that's really dangerous when these people are working in factories and industrial plants that require really dangerous work that's often hazardous for their health, whether it's in the short term or long term. And in the case of this young person that lost their fingers, that's a very serious incident that would be considered probably a national or international case if it wasn't for a foreign worker, such as this Vietnamese student. So I had a couple follow-up questions for you. And I'm not sure if you're able to disclose this, but who are these employers of these students?
So I just talked about the case of technical interns, but if we talk about the Vietnamese student, they tend to work in, because they are student, right? So they have to work part-time jobs. So the part-time jobs they choose are usually like supermarket job or convenience store, restaurant job, or even factory. So the employers, well, I would say the factories, managers, shop owners, restaurant managers. So these would be the employers of the Vietnamese student workers. Technical interns, they are usually working in factories or construction company. Factories can also be like, I met people who worked for like a clothing company, like they make clothes, or many people work in farms. So farms owners and construction companies. I met many people working in construction companies. So they would be construction companies managers.
Are there a lot of Vietnamese workers who work at farms and fisheries?
Oh, yes, I think so. Fishery, I think there are a big number of them. There are a lot of cases when they have accidents when they go out to the sea as well, I heard. But farms, yes. Many people are working in the farms. One of my professors, she did research on the like technical interns working at farms in Gunma Prefecture. So yes, many, many technical interns are working in the farm agriculture sector as well.
I've also heard of this case of a Vietnamese woman who gave birth on her own, and she gave birth to a twin. And
yes,
because she was afraid of being found out, she abandoned them. She had to abandon them to avoid deportation. And she was criminalized for it. Do you know much about this case? And would you be able to tell us about it?
This case, I just read the information. My NPO actually supported some cases related, like similar to this before, but I just heard the story from them. I was not involved, so I cannot say much. But yes, so with technical interns, female technical interns, somehow they are not allowed to have babies in Japan. And even this thing is divided. The opinion is also divided within the Vietnamese community itself. Like when we think about it, it's very horrible to see this woman had to do something like this, right? But then even within the Vietnamese community, when they see the news on this, they also, of course, some people agree that, oh, we should have supported her so she didn't have to do something like this. But then some people also said, well, Japan hired you to work, to come here and work. Why would you want to have babies? Something like that. So you see, even the Vietnamese community, they also didn't want to understand her situation. So I don't know. I wouldn't expect so much from the outsiders, from the Japanese companies, Japanese employers, or the labor, like, how do we say that? Kumiai. Kumiai is like the supervising organization of technical interns. So I wouldn't expect so much from them.
I just wanted to share something. I volunteer for Action Canada for Sexual Health and Rights, and we're a charity. I work the access line, which is a line for people to call in to access information about abortion and abortion clinics. And a large number of our clients are actually international students. So there's an expectation that people come to another country, to work or to study and nothing else. But the reality is that people come to another country and that's not all they're doing. They're getting into relationships. They're having sexual relations with people. And so these kind of incidences are inevitable. And there should be more protection for these workers and for these students, because you can't ignore that reality that it's going to still happen. So I think it's a really good point that you just made. I also had another follow-up question. In Canada and the United States, a lot of migrant workers also work on farms and in factories that are often dangerous conditions. And housing is also a huge issue. Do you find that housing is an issue for Vietnamese workers and student workers in Japan as well? Or and what kind of issues exist within housing?
With housing, I believe that most of them usually they get the accommodation from the company. So the companies, when they bring the technical interns to Japan, they have responsibility to provide them with like a place to live, either like a house or a dormitory. But this one problem is all the fee that related to the house, like of course the rent or electricity and water and other thing is controlled by the company. So it really depends on the company, though. But some companies, they really take too much from the workers when it's not that, it shouldn't be that high. For example, if you leave, usually when we think about it, technical interns, they are the what's so-called workers for the labor shortage. So they usually work in a very like rural area. And then when it's rural area of Japan, it shouldn't be that expensive. But then it's the power of the company who can decide this. So it's not like they don't have a place to live, but it would be expensive or not really depends on the attitude. It really depends in the power of the company. So some of the technical interns that I talked to, they raised their concern about this problem. And in many areas which are very, very cold in Japan in winter, because the companies, they might want to save the electricity bill, they would say like, oh, you're not allowed to use the heater. Or sometimes they just take away the heater. So that one is a little bit problematic, I think. Yeah, so that's the problems related to housing that I know.
Definitely, that's awful. Another common issue with housing is overcrowding. Have you heard of that issue at all?
Overcrowding. I think there's a rule in Japan, like one person needs like this minimum like space. So I don't think there's an overcrowding issue, but clearly there's a facility issue. So even like the place wouldn't be good for four people in a house. For example, the heater is too weak, or I wouldn't say it's a space problem, it's the facility problem.
I think what's interesting is that the employers get to exploit the workers even more, not only in the workplace, but by charging workers rent, right? Or taking it out of their paycheck. And there are also other agencies, 管理団体, I suppose, like management organization. And
oh, yes.
This aspect of intermediaries taking advantage of the labor of workers and engaging in a sort of intermediary exploitation. Would you be able to tell us about these intermediaries and how they're adding to the exploitation of the workers?
Oh my God, that's a big thing. So this candidata, as you mentioned, I believe you want to talk about the kumiai, the supervising organization, right? So companies, when they want to accept, when they want technical interns, they have to make partnership with these kind of like supervising organizations. And then the role of supervising organizations should be supporting the foreign workers. But then if we go to any community, any Vietnamese community on Facebook, that the group, the supervising organizations are the main, not target, but they are the one who are to blame the most by the Vietnamese workers, by the Vietnamese technical interns. So these supervising organizations, they take a lot of money from these workers. So when the technical interns want to be a technical intern in Japan, of course they have to go through like an agency in Vietnam first. And this agency, of course, have partnership with supervising organizations, and they decide together like a very high price, a very high fee to bring these workers to Japan. And that's even before coming to Japan, these supervising organizations already getting money from the people. And then when the technical interns come to Japan, I guess that's it. That's their responsibility. Like they wouldn't want to support these technical interns anymore. Many of them feel abandoned by the supervising organizations. At the same time, these supervising organizations are still taking money like monthly from the company, because they are hired to support the workers, right? So the company have to pay them every month, but they don't have a lot of, like they don't show any responsibility for the technical interns. I think it's just like 6 months before they started working for the company, I think the supervising organization would want to give them some basic knowledge about how to work in a Japanese company, or would teach them some Japanese. But then after that, they don't really support the workers. So for example, in the case of the person I'm supporting with his finger, like he lost his finger, nobody from the supervising organization wanted to support him. Like, if you are a supervising organization who like design, which are designed to support or supervise workers, at least you need Vietnamese interpreter or Vietnamese staff, right? But then this supervising organization, the only Vietnamese, the Japanese teacher who is a Vietnamese, the only Vietnamese staff there, she stopped working. So how do you gonna support these technical interns who don't speak Japanese if you don't have a Vietnamese staff? So you see, like, they have no motivation, or there's no purpose to support these people from the first place. That's why they are like this, I think.
Yeah, there's a really clear dynamic of the ways in which the workers are treated as commodities, and then that brings in a sort of colonial dynamic. They don't really care to communicate with the workers. They just want to treat them as things, not as human beings.
Yes.
So I want us to sort of bring it back to the experience of students. And these students also have their own intermediaries. You know, they're formally brought in as students, but they often have to work a lot, multiple jobs to pay for their tuition. Would you be able to tell us about sort of what their condition as a student and having to work at the same time?
Yes. So this one, well, because they come here as students, but then when we think about it, like, I actually interview some students. Of course, many of them want to come here and study and try to get a good job in Japan, but some of them also choose the way, like, to come here as a student to avoid being a technical intern. So the SSW visa, the specified skilled workers, was not introduced until 2019, right? So before that year, to come to Japan, not as like a high skilled workers who are like engineer or like IT engineer in Japan, there are two ways to come to Japan. The two main ways is to become an international student or to be a technical intern. And with the very bad situation of technical interns, many people want to avoid that if they can. So when they want to come here and work and earn money, some of them choose to go as international student so they can avoid the other route. And even doesn't really matter when they come here to with the main purpose of like earning a lot of money or with the purpose of studying. Unless they are from unless they are from like higher, like upper middle class family who can support them entirely with tuition fee, all of them have to work part-time jobs. Of course, for the money is one thing, but many of them also see it's a chance to study Japanese, to understand about the Japanese society. My family, my parents pay for my tuition fee, but I still worked a lot because, of course, I don't want to depend on my parents all the time. They also have to work very hard. And yes, so for me, I have the privilege to work up to 28 hours. Like, I don't have to force myself to work like illegally because I still have family to support me. But a lot of the students I interview, they are from like rural area of Vietnam, like lower middle class or low income families. They coming to Japan is a very big opportunity for them. But to be able to do that, the family have to prepare a lot of money for the fee for the agencies in Vietnam. And many of them had to take debt from families or the bank to be able to come to Japan. So they have to work hard, not just for tuition fee, but also to pay back that debt. So that's why they have to work multiple jobs and very long hours, night shift as well. And some of the students where they don't have to pay tuition fee, they get like before coming to Japan, they interview and then they got the newspaper scholarship. Have you ever heard about it?
No, I haven't.
So newspaper scholarship means that the newspaper companies in Japan will sponsor their life in Japan. They will pay tuition fee. They will pay for your accommodation. They will still give you salary as well. As long like with under one condition, you have to work for them. So distributing the newspapers is a very harsh job. You have to work overnight. I think the work starts from like 1 or 2 a.m. and finish at 5 a.m. And then the student have to go to school. After school, they have to go, they have to distribute the newspaper again from like for the afternoon, afternoon shift. So it's a very, very hard job, but it's somewhat desirable because you don't have to pay tuition fee. So, and you also have to be like a good Japanese speaker even before coming to Japan. So all these newspaper company, they would send their managers to Vietnam and do the interview. I think because of Corona, now they all do it online, but it used to be like that. And only the good students, the one who could speak a lot of Japanese, even before coming to Japan, can get this scholarship. And with a very severe shortage of labor in these kind of like newspaper companies or like the care center for elderly, they are creating more and more these kind of scholarships. So they have the that is also similar. As long as you work part-time job in the home center, in the care center for elderly, you get sponsored with your scholarship. So this is somewhat more desirable, but it's very hard work as well. So all the students, they have to work very hard with the one who have to work other jobs, multiple jobs, factories, convenience stores. They just not enough time for them to sleep, I think. Night shifts are always paid better. So they tend to do these kind of jobs. And when they go to school, it's very difficult for them to keep up with the class. And then I interview a Japanese teacher in a Japanese language school before. I asked her, like, what is the problem if the students come to class and they don't study, they just sleep? And she's like, oh, it's okay. As long as student come to class, it's okay. If student disappear or they don't come to class, that is the problem. The school will face some punishment from the government for like losing the student. So as long as they come to class, it's okay. It's better than not showing up. So the school also have very lenient treatment towards the students, like the language school students.
So these schools are very profit-driven rather than caring for their students. How do they get hired? Do they get hired while they're in Japan or while they're still in Vietnam?
So first question about the language schools. So that is a very big problem. I mean, now I think 98% of the schools are all private businesses. And unless it's like a, of course, there's also with schools, there's also a ranking, even with language school. So the school with high tuition fee, they tend to be a little bit better. So because they have like good reputation, student can go to, can advance to higher education, something like that. So they keep the tuition fees very high. And then when we look at the student that I interviewed, they would want to prioritize the cheap tuition fee, right? And then when you get something cheap, it's not always the best option. So when they go into like school with a little bit cheaper tuition fee, the schools do not really provide the best education for them. And your second question is about how do they get hired for these part-time jobs? So I think except for the students who came here under the scholarship of the newspaper company or the home care center, they all have to find a job after they come to Japan. The other, they already got a job before coming, and when they came, they just started right away. because they already finished all the interview with the companies already. But with other students, they are introduced to their job by acquaintances, like other students in class or the senpai, the people who came to Japan before them, the Vietnamese community usually. So they usually get hired through connections.
Are there like an agency similar to the kumiai or, kanriyantai that take advantage of technical interns? Are there similar organizations that profit from the worker, the student's exploitation?
I don't think so. Yes.
Okay.
So, yes, there's no agencies, but clearly there are some job brokers for sure. So many of the students who first come to Japan, they don't know anyone and their English, I know their Japanese skill is not so good yet. So many of these brokers would try to find students and get money from them for the introduction fee. And then in many cases, these brokers get money from both sides. So they get money from the students and they also get money, the introduction, like they give the thank you money from the company as well. So yes, this is not an agency, but just like brokers. And sometimes they even have like, I'm not so sure if it's still happening now, but it happened when I first came to Japan. Now there might be more jobs, so they don't have to go through brokers anymore. But there's also like a lot of scams. Like they get money from you and then they just disappear, never really introduce you a job. So, but I believe the situation is less now because there are more jobs to do, especially in big cities, I think.
Yeah, there's almost like quadruple layers of exploitation because bosses, employers, brokers, schools, and the debt. So it's really, there's an intense pressure that they're under. You know, they really have not a lot of choices, even though they might have a slightly better conditions than the technical interns.
Mm. Yes.
So you mentioned earlier that most of the media coverage that comes from these issues surrounding Vietnamese students and temporary workers and interns, a lot of the coverage is negative because it usually happens when one of these foreign workers attacks someone or if there's another tragic case. But what other coverage exists in Japan? And on the other hand of these issues, is there much coverage surrounding when workers get exploited and get injured, like the case that you mentioned earlier? Does that get covered at all in the media?
Yeah, this one, not official media for sure. So people would see things, let's say on TikTok or like on Twitter, they would talk about it. But to see the Japanese media, I don't think they focus this like a lot on the situation. When I talk to many of my Japanese students, I teach English to Japanese students, like adults, they are very not so aware about the situation. Like when I said, I still remember one time when I came into class and I say I'm from Vietnam, one of the students just instantly mentioned about like a criminal case recently, like at that time in Japan, like Vietnamese trying to like steal the piglets. So yeah, it was kind of surprising. Like the first thing you know, they know about Vietnam is they know about their Vietnamese people. Yeah, just criminal cases. All the abuses on technical interns, I think it's just more popular on the Vietnamese media in Japan. So now there are a lot of like Vietnamese media company that they just broadcast information about Japan. So yeah, just among the Vietnamese community. I don't think the Japanese media really talk about this problem. They only talk about very extreme cases, like the things you know, like abortion, or there's a case of the one lady, like she passed away in the detention center in Japan. But the case of people dying in detention center is not new at all, but nobody knew about it. So yeah, they just somehow they just talk about it briefly at one time and then just let it go, I think. So yeah, that's my how I see the media, like how they talk about foreigners in Japan.
That's a great answer. And it's great that there is alternative media that covers this these issues, but it is also very tragic that it seems like the way that Japanese people perceive Vietnamese people is either they're villains or they're victims, and there's no positive representation of these Vietnamese people in Japan. So it is really awful that the media doesn't cover these issues.
That is an excellent point, Maya. And how Vietnamese migrants are criminalized and racialized as well as a threatening foreign outsiders, right? Like disturbing the orderly existence of Japanese society and, you know, everydayness that is conducive to the maintenance of the capitalist system. Mm. And it really ignores the sort of conditions, you know. I think read about one case where the rural people, like rural Japanese people, are complaining about the Vietnamese workers stealing their livestock, you know, and stuff like that. But we don't really hear about the conditions these workers live in. And, you know, this applies to the case of Lynn, you know, right? Like woman worker who had to abandon her child and had to be criminalized for it. Like it really needed to look at beyond the surface of this discourse, you know, what's causing, you know, what's pushing them into these desperate actions, you know, poverty or, you know, lack of rights, or just the fear of deportation and being found out by the immigration authorities. It's really, I think it's really important to highlight that, in my opinion.
Yes. And talking about media, I just remember something. It's very disturbing in a way, but every time when they see like a case of, let's say, like stealing, and they don't know the culprit yet, and all the in the comment section, there'll be, you know, that in Japan, in Vietnam, the Nguyen is a very common family name. And then they just, some people would comment like, oh, it's Nguyen Sang again. Oh, it's Mr. Nguyen again, something like that. So they just assume that we are the criminals. So I think it's a very disturbing thing that like the media had kind of made people into. So it's kind of sad to see that.
Yes. Yeah, they really play a role in obscuring the realities and the conditions that these Vietnamese migrants live in Japan. But they also really sort of cut off their international existence or the reality of migration as well. They sort of try to just portray something happening in the backyard or like, you know, just a issue that's particular to Japan. And even among the sort of advocates of migrant rights in Japan, there is a tendency to sort of just focus on the rights of migrants here and fight for their rights, which is necessary, and I support it. But I think we also need to talk about the root cause of migration and international situation that is causing the migration in the first place, such as imperialism and the inequality between the global north and global south. And there's a really memorable paragraph in your article that you co-author with Torao. In the conclusion, I just wanted to read it to you. So this is the conclusion of the article called Knowing Your Place. Franz Fanon once wrote, quote, "In the colonies, the economic infrastructure is also a superstructure. The cause is effect. You are rich because you are white. You are white because you are rich," unquote. And yeah, this is a quote from Franz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. And then you write, this passage describes the way through which ideas of ethnic and cultural hierarchy are connected to the economic division between the colonized and the colonists. The implication of Fanon's observation goes beyond the bygone days of colonialism to describe the current international political economic order between the global North and the global South. So I wanted to, if you can, I wanted to ask you to discuss how this struggle of Vietnamese migrant workers in Japan relate to the history of the colonization and neo-colonization of Vietnam by imperialist nations. You mentioned earlier a lot of student workers or technical interns, they come from rural areas and, you know, even they may come from more middle-class background, they experience downward mobility because of currency and also all these multiple layers of exploitation we discussed earlier. And yeah, they have to work a lot of hours, like you had to when you're a student also. Yeah, I'm wondering how this, what is your analysis of the conditions in Vietnam that are causing it and the current international situation that's really leading to the exploitation of Vietnamese workers in Japan?
Yes. So when you read that paragraph in the conclusion, yeah, that's clearly my friend Torao's voice here. I can see his voice very clearly here. But yeah, I can talk a little bit about this based on how I understand about the situation. So colonization. Japan actually colonized Vietnam for like 2 years only. I think it was towards the end of the Second World War. So I'm not like, from my experience, is it like a bit of a stretch if we talk about colonization or neo-colonization? But from the experience of myself and the people who I interview in my research, of course, there's clearly an ethnic and cultural hierarchy that exists in Japan. Yeah, the Japanese population, the Japanese community, the Japanese people are, of course, always at the top of this hierarchy. And maybe the white people can be in the same position with them, or it, like, yeah, I'm not so sure. But other Asian looking people from Southeast Asia, of course, we are under them in the culture and ethnic hierarchy. And I think no matter how much we try, we are always seen as the low wage laborers of Japan. So mainly, like, we come here, we try our best to leave our country and come to a new country without knowing the language and everything. Like, I don't know if they can see that we are trying our best. And they are very ignorant about the development of other countries, I believe. So they, when I was working in the factory, I was working in the sushi restaurant. He was the manager of the restaurant. And they just kept asking us, apparently this doesn't just happen to me. It happened to many other people. They asked about Vietnam. They asked, do you live like on the water in Vietnam? Do you have TV in Vietnam? Do you have knife? Like they see us like they don't recognize us as a developing nation. Their ideas about other countries, about Southeast Asian countries, is like kind of like stuck in the past. And even until now, I don't know why it's happening. Is it because of the education? But they are very ignorant about other countries. And when you hear something like that, you'd feel very offensive, feel very offended in a way. But like, really, it really make me question it. Like, what is the problem of this? Is it because of education? Or is it because, yeah, as you mentioned here, is it like a very neo-colonial, like, what's the word? Sorry, neo-colonization idea that give them like this notion that they don't have to know or understand about other countries. So, yes.
Yeah, sorry, I should have clarified what I meant by neocolonialism. How I understand it is that as opposed to colonialism, when one country openly occupies another country and imposes its rule on the colonized peoples, like violently, often. Neocolonialism is a sort of post-World War II order where the colonizer nations, they formally recognize the independence of the global south nations. You know, they recognize as their own independent nation states on paper, but they still exploit these countries economically through institutions such as IMF and the World Bank. And Vietnam also achieved its liberation. You know, they defeated the Americans, the U.S. imperialism. And it's supposedly pursuing independent, passive development. But a lot of Vietnamese people have to migrate to make their living, right? Either technical interns or international students. So to me, this seems like a neo-colonial situation, you know, because these migrants, they could ideally, in a sort of, in my vision of socialism and how socialism should work out, or, you know, sort of like the politics of national liberation, they shouldn't have to leave, right? They would probably rather just build their own nation as opposed to going to other countries to work. And, you know, being a source of cheap labor. Yeah. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So now I understand your point a little bit clearer now. So, yes. So as you said, they would hope to be treated as equal or independent. But clearly we can see that I'm not sure about the, like how the Japanese government try to like portray their relationship with Vietnam, but from all of the stories that we heard, they are like the how the Japanese economy is treating the migrant workers from Vietnam is right. Like we talk about, like Vietnam is the when we think about the world system theory, like Japan is the core country, right? Japan is the core, and then Vietnam is like a peripheral country that send the cheap labor to Japan. And then Japan, of course, still bringing, like sending products from Japan to Vietnam and selling with very high price because it's from Japan, even though it might be made by the Vietnamese people's hand in Japan. So I think that's also one way that they remain this kind of relationship. So, right, like we are always the supply of cheap labor force, and they can still make money by giving, like sending us, selling us the products with the Japanese label on it. So, yeah, I think that's how I can comment about this situation. That's how I see this.
I have one more follow-up question. What is the Vietnamese government's policy towards the Vietnamese migrants abroad?
Vietnamese policy for migrant abroad?
Like, do they regulate the intermediary agencies, or like, do they regulate like recruitment agency that exists, or do they encourage the Vietnamese people to stay, or do they actually like help them migrate? And, you know, do they try to ensure their rights are protected abroad and so forth? Like, what is their overall policy towards migration?
This one, I should have looked into this as well, but I have to admit, I don't really know much about this situation. But what I can say is that Japan when Japan tried to attract the workers from Vietnam, of course, they have to set like a relationship. They have to introduce, the Japanese government have to introduce this kind of like program to the Vietnamese government. But talking about regulation on agencies, clearly there's no strict regulation for now. So they can still kind of exploit the workers even before they left Vietnam or the agencies. And this very, very recent thing that also make me question about this kind of regulation is Vietnam is one of the like main partners in the new visa, the SSW, specified skilled workers visa with Japan. They set up like an official partnership, but only in Vietnam, there's no. So to be able to get this visa status, the workers would have to, the potential workers have to take like an examination, like a certificate, like a license even, but to confirm their skill so they can come to Japan and work. But only in Vietnam, there's no examination at all. Even in Cambodia, they have the examination. Vietnam now, the SSW category, Vietnam is currently, I think, about 60 to 70% of them are Vietnamese. But there's no examination being held in Vietnam. So when I asked my interviewees on this, and then I asked, like, what do you think that might be the reason? And they said, oh, you know, maybe all the agencies are working with the government to make sure there's no examination in Vietnam. So they can provide these kind of new services, like they will bring the student, the potential workers to other countries and get more money out of it. So yes, I really question about this. There's not enough regulation, and at the same time, they're also working with each other for profit. Just my opinion. Like, there might be some lobby going on that to make sure that the agencies can maximize their profit. That is my assumption. I'm not so sure if it's really going on or not. This is my assumption that I gather from the information that I gather from my interviewees.
Yeah, I'm involved with the solidarity movement, with the National Democratic Movement in the Philippines. And one of the groups that I work with is Migrante International, which is an international organization of Filipino migrants fighting for their rights in many countries that have Filipino workers working in. And I know in the case of Philippines, the remittance from overseas Filipino workers constitute a really large proportion of the GDP. So maybe there's a similar dynamic happening there with Vietnam. They're trying to take advantage of the global inequality and sort of the unequal exchange between the North and South, and they try to basically profit from it. And it's really unfortunate situation because of the legacy of decolonization and the really bloody war that it took to liberate the country from the U.S. imperialism. But yeah, I think there's more. Yeah, there's more research to be done, and I'm really interested in finding out more about it. If you end up doing more research on this in the future,
Yes. So this is one of our last questions. We're curious to know how Vietnamese student workers and their allies, such as the NPO that you mentioned earlier, are fighting back against this regime of super exploitation.
So as I said before, so the students, they have an exit option. So they still think this is like an acceptable situation. So I haven't really encountered any demonstration or protest on the life of Vietnamese students. But for sure, we have seen a lot of cases where people are fighting for the rights of the technical interns. So for example, like in the NPO that I mentioned that I'm working for, they have been supporting a lot of cases trying to get, so most of the time is when there's misconduct on human rights or labor rights from the company on the technical interns. And usually it's the case when they refuse to pay the workers, or when they refuse to let the workers stay and work or something like that. Or of course the case of when it comes to more cases of abortion or having being pregnant as well. So they supported, I believe that many NPOs, NGOs in Japan are really helping these people to get the treatment that they deserve. Of course, it's not all places. Many people they don't talk about it. Or sometimes and I think also many of these workers, they don't realize that there are people who are working in this kind of field to support them. They don't realize that they can get proper support. So yeah, instead of asking for support, instead of trying to fight back, they just choose the exit option. And the exit option for Vietnamese students, for the student worker is, that is just quitting their job and changing to a new one. They can still have their student status. But with technical interns, if you choose the exit option, it means you go undocumented. So then once you go undocumented, it's so difficult because they would be considered as illegal migrants, right? In Japan, they wouldn't have any status. So of course, I believe that there are still organizations who try to support these people. But I believe that it's just put them in a more vulnerable state, that even NPO also find it difficult to support them in a way. So I think that the allies or the NPO, NGO, they are doing their best. But we also have to increase the hope from the workers as well. I think they should have, they should be able to have hope. More of them should have more hope that there will be people are there and supporting them. I think this is something that it's still lacking in the migrant workers community in Japan.
Mm-hmm. It seems like a very difficult situation. And I'm still wrapping my head around what you said earlier about Japanese people being so ignorant of these Vietnamese students and workers and, of Vietnam as a country, just thinking that Vietnam is so behind Japan and having all these really racist assumptions. And that definitely plays a role in how Japanese media and how society as a whole views Vietnamese people, which is really awful. And there needs to be some kind of systemic change to really challenge that narrative that currently exists. Mm. Are there any ways that international allies can support? Or do you think it's very limited at the moment?
International ally. I mean, even the Vietnamese government, I'm not so sure I believe that they are very informed about the situation, but they are not, I don't think the Vietnamese government is trying much in supporting these people. They don't have any push for the Japanese government in a way. Yeah, clearly that might be because of the political hierarchy, economic hierarchy in a way. So even the Vietnamese government is ignorant about this. I come from Vietnam and this kind of thing, having international support, it's not something that I think about. That's not something that I hope about. So yes, for now, I am not so sure about this. Yes, I'm not so sure how the international community can see and support the situation. Mm. But yeah, I just said before, the workers should be able to have hope, but it seems like even for me, my hope is very thin. about the situation.
I also find it difficult to be optimistic sometimes. But yeah, there was a lot of mobilization in Japan against the change in the immigration law, right, to make it possible to deport migrants more easily. And, you know, their excuse is to reduce indefinite detention of migrants, which is horrific on its own, of course. And, you know, this is also tied to the struggle of workers as well. Like, these things often kind of get discussed separately, like the technical interns issues and migrant detention issues. And people kind of tend to focus more on like refugees and asylum seekers. But, you know, economic migrants, you know, the mainstream media and the discourse in general try to draw this arbitrary distinction between refugee versus migrants, you know, refugees as being sort of like good migrants and migrants and migrant workers, or the so-called economic migrants, right? They're bad. They're just sort of like, they're just doing it on their own volition, and they're, or worse, they're trying to basically take people's jobs away, or, you know, sort of xenophobic discourse there. But, you know, I think that distinction is arbitrarily, and it's not really grounded on reality. You know, economic migrants also have no choice. They are forced into a situation, you know, because of poverty and because of neoliberal reforms or like deregulation and unequal exchange and, you know, underdevelopment of global South nations. So yeah, it's really, I think it's important to connect these dots and, yeah, have a sort of international analysis as well. But, you know, those of us in a diaspora as well, the Japanese diaspora, or just people from Japan living abroad in places like Canada, which Maya and myself are, in 2022, as I mentioned earlier, we had a rally in front of Japanese consulate Toronto to protest the treatment of a Filipina transgender woman who was being detained. She's out now, but yeah, I don't want us to take too much credit for our mobilization, but it kind of became a sort of international campaign. Like, there's some folks here in Canada and the US and, you know, some Europe. So, and of course, there's a lot of, you know, she had a lot of supporters, migrant rights organizations in Japan that are supporting her. So really that kind of pushback really make a difference, you know, sometimes, perhaps not always, you know, even though there was this massive mobilization against the change in immigration, still couldn't stop them. So, but, you know, really, it's really this famous slogan by Mao that I buy by, you know, the masses are the makers of history. You know, people are the ones that who make history and change the reality. So, yeah. Yeah. So that's my semi-optimistic note in there. Just, you know, keep fighting. And yeah. Maya, would you like to add anything to that?
I was just going to add on to say that I believe that this solidarity is very important, and it gives me a bit of hope as well that there are people that are supporting these people from Vietnam in Japan, and that there's also alternative forms of media like social media that can help get this message across. And just any kind of exposure is a form of education, and hopefully an opportunity for it to grow into an international solidarity movement. So thank you for your work as well, Anne, for studying this issue, for writing about this issue, and for joining us on this podcast today, because I think that's also one of the first steps in creating a larger movement.
Yes, so thank you so much for having me. This is just my opinion, and also this, I'm still very new to the field of academic research. So I really hope that I could give you some insight about the situation of Vietnamese migrant workers in Japan. Yes, and as you said, we just have to keep fighting and be optimistic about the future, because as long as we don't stop, I think we can make this situation better. Even a little, I think it's still much better than the current situation, right?
Yeah, that's a good place to end. Thank you so much, Anne, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, please keep us updated on your future research. And yeah, I Love to learn more about the situation.
You already know, Greenhouse 25号の池田市民宣言する俺のスタンスそれを見てワイドショーのおさは濡らすパンツ怖がんなって言っても悪魔かかかわいそうキャラじゃなくて人間に見られんの100年かかりそう OK ならレッツゴー偏見を裏返しするまいし胸を張って Get that dough日本のリベラル調子はどう、huh? 朝日新聞 Fuck you pay me 技能実習生たちは味わえない日本の正義だから俺が成し遂げた全て移民の名義一つずつ手に入れていこう家族ビザ Get that dough カンクーで出すパスポート入荷の前に財布の中の材料カード俺の ID 働きが終わった後も俺はここで生きてる知らないMoment は意味 Moment は意味